Theology is not my field, but I think I'm going to have to get my toes wet today, but just slightly, and I'm going to run back and lie on the beach for a while. We have to start with a few statements, I think, to try to understand, first of all, what we mean by sin and evil. And the reason I want to do this is because I want to show some continuity between ancient or more recent and contemporary societies in the way that they handle certain problems. And we think of, because we use a different terminology, there's a tendency to think, well, maybe the same problems don't exist. But that's what I want to try to show you, that that's not true. That, in fact, some of these problems are pretty ancient, and some of the attempts to solve them have been, go back a long ways. And that we use different methods today. But we still are faced with some of the same difficulties. The first point there, whatever happened to sin and evil, I think that's the name of a book. I've heard that someplace. Is it by Maslow?
No,
Menninger. Menninger. Psychotherapy or psychiatry has had some connection with theology, especially in recent years. I know Maslow and Menninger have written quite a bit about this, and there seems to have been a period where there wasn't a lot of discussion in psychiatry or psychotherapy about religious meanings or relationships, but it seems to have come back a little bit more recently. There's a couple, especially there's a psychiatrist by the name of Peck, who's been writing about evil and sin and spiritual growth and connecting that up to mental illness. So it looks like sin and evil are making a comeback again. So maybe I represent that too here today. Whatever happened to sin and evil, I think that in this century, the secularization of our society and the development of science, social science and psychology and so on, developed an optimism that somehow we could take care of problems of evil, things that we used to call evil. Around the turn of the century, there were these conventions at The Hague and in the Netherlands to try to eliminate war or try to develop rules surrounding war. It goes back further than that, though. I think in the settlement of this country, the early colonial villages, these people came to this country with the idea of constructing utopian societies where somehow sin and evil would not rear their ugly heads, and that if they based them on some principles of Christianity and employed or used these principles to function in their daily lives, then problems of social disunity resulting from sin and evil could be avoided. So I think that goes way back. And this tendency to think that we can conquer over sin and evil. The development of social science in this century was centered around social problem issues in this country. And that's interesting because the social problems approach did not develop in Europe. Did not develop, or has not developed to this day in Europe, European social science. That European social science is maintained on a much more theoretical level of trying to explain and understand society. The idea behind social problems is that if you can identify a social problem, find its causes, then eliminate those causes, then everything's going to be fine. In, I guess it was 1950s, a book came out by B.F. Skinner called Walden 2, in which he used behavior modification or operant conditioning principles to try to show how a society could be constructed so that problems from sin and evil, or problems that we call by different names these days. Incidentally, under the seven deadly sins there, I've tried to put some of the translations or some of the different terminology that we use these days. You may think of your own terms. I just thought those up off the top of my head. Skinner's idea was that by raising children under certain principles of conditioning, these problems of egotism or social dysfunction and so on would not occur. He went so far as to recruit some people to go off someplace and form a society based on his principles, but I don't know what happened to that. I don't think it ever got off the ground, really. I think those are all sources of, or reasons for which we sort of lost sight of these concepts of sin and evil. But there, and then there's been a lot of disillusionment in this century about these possibilities. We've had the course of the Nazi Holocaust, and there's other indications that of the inhumanity of that humans have for one another from time to time. And so this question has come up often in some of the discussions earlier this week and last week about human progress in this area, whether humanitarian values, whether we can see some progress in these areas or not. But I think we can. I've talked about this in terms of punishment, changes in the way that we handle crime over time. We can see it in terms of the difference in the way that we regard children, that we don't just regard them as weak, slave-like adults. Infanticide has been reduced to a great extent. The idea that we need to nurture children is a new idea in this century. The idea that parents can do anything to their kids they want to, sell them or whatever, is an idea that we don't hold any longer. We see changes in terms of sexism, racism in those areas, the way that wives are treated, women are treated in society. But I think we're discouraged because we expect more than our forebears did. And so when we see lapses back, we tend to think, well, you know, times haven't changed at all. One of the things that the question that came up in one of the sessions from Terry Fretheim was, well, what is it? What is this force that moves us along? Why has this evolution taken place if we can agree that there's been some evolution? And the theological answer, of course, is love, and the way that we've opened ourselves and grown spiritually over the centuries. In a sense, then, if that's what pushes us, is love, then we can sort of see that sin and evil are lapses back, or sort of taking the easy way out of falling victim to our own passions. There's a good discussion of sin and evil in Romans from about chapters 5 through 8. If you have a book, a Bible, then you might want to look at that for a second. Love, or God, makes us want to evolve spiritually and come closer to God. And the force, God gives us this force, this evolutionary force, to evolve both spiritually and physically. If you look at Romans chapter 7, verse 18... where Paul says, "For I know that nothing good dwells within me, that is, for I know that nothing good dwells within me, that is, in my flesh. I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. Now if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I that do it, but sin which dwells within me." So this is this notion that we all have these propensities to fall back. In other words, to not make the effort towards spiritual growth. That we take the easy way out, that we fall victim to our passions and let those rule us. And to evolve spiritually then, or to overcome our sins, is hard work. It takes effort, and takes application, takes suffering, and so on. And so it's something that we have to be constantly aware of and working at, and that we can't be lazy about. Why does God do this? Why does God want us to evolve this way? If you look at Romans chapter 8, verse 13, I think the answer is there. "For if you live according to the flesh, you will die, but if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God." In other words, what God wants us to do is become godlike. He wants us to become God with him, and or her. And so this is the end, and this is what we're working toward. And the spiritual growth that's required, is a lifelong process. And sin and evil then represent a failure to do this, to make this growth. So, in a way, sin is, getting back to number two there, what is sin and evil? Sin is maybe the failure to, the failure or the unwillingness to extend oneself, to open up to other members of the human race, and to love. And so so we can maybe define sin in terms of the opposite of love. I think sin is meaningful on this kind of personal level. Evil, maybe we could look at as the consequence of our sins. And so this is where sin has social meaning, or where it has consequences for society. Evil might be active sin, active anti-love, coercing, manipulating others so that they may avoid love and their own spiritual growth, objectifying others in the service or as fodder for our own sins. Evil is real. If you look at Romans 5:20, I think you see one of the consequences of evil, that the awareness of evil turns us away from evil. The awareness of evil kind of makes us sick to our stomach and want to avoid it. And that the evil exists in the world turns us on to love and in another way. Chapter 5, verse 20 says, law came in to increase the trespass, but where sin increased, grace abounded all the more, so that as sin reigned in death, grace also might reign through righteousness to eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. So that's where evil put Jesus up there on the cross, but then elevated Jesus so that we could all see him better and see a different way in a stronger light. So I think we see the consequences of evil in our society or in other societies or in war and so on in modern days in the same way, as a sign of our lack of growth and therefore an impetus to push us in a different direction. Sins, I want to emphasize, are natural human propensities. The concept of original sin is one, of course, that's much debated and a lot of people deny, mainly because they tend to look at a little baby, you know, 6 pounds, 7 ounce, bouncing baby, boy or girl, and say, what? Sin? I suppose there's nothing more sinful than a little baby. Total selfishness. But that's one way of interpreting that. But I want to avoid that discussion, but what I do want to point out is that sin involves natural human propensities. So to avoid sin means that we go against nature. And again, that takes effort. And it isn't natural then that humans should go in this direction. And a lot of people even fall back on that as an argument for not doing good. That, you know, back in the old days they used to hang them high as a way of taking care of difficulties in society. And why shouldn't we do that today? Let's look at the sins. Let me see if that's what I wanted to say about that. Let's look at the sins. And what I want to do as we look at some of these is to try to understand why they're sins. And because they're natural human propensities, how society tends to regulate them or how society has regulated them. And because they're always there and they're natural, it's impossible to completely suppress them. Even though societies from time to time have tried to do that with some of these. But when the suppression takes place, the sins tend to come out in different directions or different channels. It's like, you know, the dike that has a hole in it, you know, or something like that. You plug one hole and something comes out the other hole. That's kind of what society's experience with these sins has been. So lots of society, one tendency, of course, or possibility, is to channel the sins in socially useful directions. And some, so you find that from one society to the next, depending on the sin and the time and the place. And then I also want to look at the evil results, and especially look at these in terms of up-to-date, more contemporary manifestations of evil. And then how we dramatize these sins, what the drama of sin is in our society today. That is, how we depict these sins. And this gets in sometimes into the area of scapegoating. In other words, we lay the blame for the sin on some individuals or on some entities in society. We punish those, and then it relieves us of the responsibility for our own spiritual growth. Okay, any comments before I begin? I know I've said a lot of things you probably disagree with or have questions about. As I said, I'm not really a theologian, so it's hard for me to come at this from that direction. So now we'll get into the sociology part of it.
I think
death and entropy have a very common, connection to one another. Entropy is the idea that the universe is winding down, that energy is being depleted, so that someday everything will stop. And you see how akin that is to death. But I think that's true. I talked about growth. And Paul in Romans continually talks about life and death in relationship to sin. So I don't have any trouble with that. I think that's a good insight. I wish I would have said that. Okay. Yeah, I got to write that, remember that. Sloth is an interesting one. What do you think of when you think of sloth? Sloths, right? Waste? Okay, in what sense? What does it mean to be slothful?
Lethargy.
Yeah, lethargy, laziness. Why is that a sin?
A Puritan sense.
A Puritan sense, okay, in the sense that, well, if nobody did anything, you know, there would be no work that gets done. It's like the story about, you know, the little red hand, you know, making the bread. Nobody helps out.
The concept that rest comes after work.
Right, rest comes after work. Work is first.
I see sloth differently.
I do too. I see it as an inability or an unwillingness to overcome it, to even try, to accept that that's the normal way of being and not even to make an effort to change it.
Okay. You notice that there's something interesting when we think about sins, I think in common, and maybe you don't, because you probably all have had a lot of experience in learning about Christianity, but I think in general the secular society thinks about sin in terms of specific acts, like kill, steal, adultery, you know, those kinds of things. You notice that none of these have anything to do with acts. They're all motivations, attitudes. Or what I said, propensities. Sloth, I think maybe you're getting at probably what a lot of theologians would consider to be the basic meaning of sloth. It's no desire to improve oneself. It's to fall back. Maybe, and that's why I put depression or melancholy up there. And in a way, this is a problem of our, you see how this is a problem of our modern society. You know, what should we do? What direction should we go in? Where do we get our direction from? Who authors us these days? The word authority, you see, has this root word author, and that means authoring direction. Who gives direction in our society? Where is it going? And in our own lives. Sloth developed another meaning in because of monastical life during the Middle Ages. And this was when these people are in these monasteries, they start having idle thoughts. You know, I mean, you're supposed to think about God and good all the time, but nobody can do that 20, you know, all waking hours. So people started having other idle thoughts. Acidy was the sin that referred to idle thoughts. And boredom is another meaning of sloth. When people aren't doing anything, they get bored. And what do bored people do? They commit sins, right? Idle hands are the something, devil's tools or something
it's
like that.
It's perhaps a sinfulness of sloth, because if you are slothful, you are not making good use of the gifts that God has given you.
Okay.
I mean, it has nothing to do with acts, but being a good steward to the gifts that you have been provided with.
Right. Also, I think, you know, like if you're not doing good, too, that is another thing, you know, if we're not active in terms of our spiritual growth. But you notice how sloth is dramatized in modern society. When we, you know, laziness. Who do we think of when we think of the lazy people? Welfare cheats, right? We want somebody who's going to... Right. You know, we let the welfare cheats carry the burden of this particular problem for us. But you notice how sloth is a problem of leisure. You know, work is, or non-work, leisure is a problem of all modern technologically advanced societies. What are people going to do with their free time? Look how much waste people build into their free time, that they use it to avoid growth. What happened, you know, retirement. You know, the whole idea of retirement. The death rate of for men who retire, you know, within the first 6 months or the first year of their retirement is incredibly high. You know, a life of work and then nothing. You see how this presents problems for our society. I was just reading yesterday, you know, about what's going to happen in the year 2050 when there's so many more millions of older people going to be around with nothing to do except absorb the resources of our society. Pride is another, I put it up there, egotism. But I think pride is a difficult one to deal with for us in modern societies. Pride was obviously a sin to tribal peoples because it meant making oneself better than one's fellow tribal persons. You know, setting oneself up as being superior. This in the Middle Ages, it comes down and still to today with certain kinds of pride, like scholarly pride. You know, people who are well educated feel that they're better than other people, or people with power may feel that they're better than their fellow persons. This opens the door for a lot of evil, evil having to do with genocide. Racism, sexism, those types of evil that we see in modern society. But in tribal societies, you see it's a person that stands out and says, look, I have a higher status for one reason or another, is really putting their life on the line. In many cases, they either turn out to be a great prophet like Moses that turns the people around and puts them in a different direction, or else they're crucified. There's not a lot of middle ground for pride in tribal societies. The I was talking to an anthropologist one time who was telling me a story that he had heard about one of his colleagues who was studying a tribe in East Africa. And I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the Maasai, but I'm not sure. But after he had been there for a year among those people, he wanted to throw a feast for them. So he went out and got this big steer and slaughtered it. And of course, this was something really big for these people. They normally didn't have access to so much food all at once. And so the feast was prepared. And he said, okay, you know, where's the effect? Okay, go to it. And nobody moved. Nobody took a bite. Nobody would approach the food. And he, you know, stayed around for a little while and he ate some himself. And they didn't move at all. And pretty soon, you know, he started to feel a little affronted. It showed that, you know, like after a year of living with these people, he probably didn't understand them at all. And pretty soon he left. The moment he left, they tore into it and devoured it, every last morcel. And afterwards, you know, in in figuring out why this had happened, he realized that for them to participate in this feast would be to acknowledge his position, his superior position. And that was an evil in their society, you know, to set somebody up like that. Great harm could come to a person like that. It's, you know, they were trying to avoid making this anthropologist sin by acknowledging his gift. It's interesting that the books in the Old Testament and the Psalms, how the writers don't take authorship, you know, personal authorship. They ascribe the authorship to some famous person. And you notice how different that is in our modern society. Authorship is of utmost importance. If there's two authors, it's which one comes first. You know, these kinds of things. You know, it shows the isolation of the individual in modern society and how we have left this sense of tribal unity and dependence on the tribe. And maybe pride, or maybe another term for it is self-actualization or individual self-interest. Maybe the mode of overcoming the depersonalization of modern society. And we're thrust into this kind of depersonalized existence where so much of our life takes place within these highly organized, large bureaucracies where we don't really feel a part of. Most of us maybe just are consumers of them. But even in our work situations, we find ourselves a part of these larger entities that we may not even have much to say about. And this responsibility for oneself then, or narcissism, in modern society may be a defense mechanism or actually a tool to overcome this situation. But the consequences of that sometimes are evil in terms of the decline or the disorder in some of our social institutions, like of traditional institutions, like the family and employment, and so on. Lust is probably the one that society has tried the most to control and has failed to the most degree over time. It's probably the one that you can find more kinds of ways that society has tried to control it, more of a variety, and also find unwanted evil consequences because of the suppression. I think a good contemporary example of this is Islamic society. To protect women, you know, to put them under the care of a man or a father or a husband, to isolate them, to dress them in such a way that they're veiled, to keep them separate in the marketplace from men. All of these things to prevent lust drives men crazy with lust. In the Middle East and Arabic societies, this, you know, then the misuse or the objectification of women for sexual purposes is a natural outcome. So the common belief among Islamic males is they, in order to maintain their manhood, they have to have sex at least 3 times a day. You need a stable of women, I suppose, for something like that. But also the dehumanization of women is also a result of that. And lust, it becomes one of the foremost obsessions in those societies. In the development of Christianity and Western civilization, there has been the attempt to suppress both sex and aggression. And because of that, our Western cultures have little understanding of the proper place and performance and meaning of sex and aggression. There's a hypothesis by a woman named Beatrice Faust to try to understand rape in this regard, or sexual aggression by males in this regard. If you look at very traditional Eastern Oriental societies, they have a long tradition in literature about the proper methods, performance, places, time of sex. And also they've institutionalized aggression in certain kinds of games, certain activities, martial arts, those types of things. Because our society doesn't do that, it's a lot like when we were talking the other day about alcoholism. The alcoholism rate among abstaining cultures is very high among those who drink, because they don't have any understanding or teachings about the proper place and time to drink. And so you find us coming out of this era of severe sexual repression with the same problems. And so the connection between aggression and sexuality is very strong in Western civilization, and in the United States too. And there's a tendency for males to believe that the two are combined, that they go together. That sex is a part, and aggression are a part of one another. We have a whole long period of time that we're going to have to go through to teach people proper, males especially, proper place of sex and aggression in our society, if we're going to overcome some of these problems that that have resulted. Societies have tried everything from castration. Castration is an interesting one, because when that's been tried in the past, you get a class of males that have no proper social place. You know, there's nothing for them. There's no social role for them. Sometimes it's created. The Chinese emperors, for example, and Middle Eastern or in that area of the world, the employment of eunuchs. Eunuchs were very trustworthy persons, because there's only one job you can do. That's work for the king. There's nothing else. So they tended to align themselves with the emperor and the emperor's family. But when you have severe problems of unemployment and poverty in a society, and then you open up a new channel of success or gaining status, then of course people flock toward that. You know, it's like when an advertisement for some unskilled job, like a janitorial job, comes up and you have 3,000 applicants for one job. Well, that's what would happen in those societies. So families would castrate their males and send them off to the emperor. Of course, the emperor couldn't use all these eunuchs. So what are they going to do? Well, what they tended to do was take off to the hills and form gangs and come down and raid the villages. That was their the outlet, or the place that they found in the society for their lack of or isolation, lack of involvement. Luther, when after the Reformation, again found it necessary to, as Paul had done, as St. Thomas Aquinas had done, to try to, well, okay, now we're going to have a new society. What are we going to do about sex? And so to develop a whole series of teachings and caveats about the proper place of the family, the values, ordering the values in relationship to sexuality and the performance of sexuality. Lust tends to get associated with other sins. And I wanted to mention this, especially in relationship to war, because rape has a strong presence in war, and by the conquering heroes, you know, or the conquering group, to take women and to vent whatever they're venting through the crime of rape. Lust becomes associated in war with things like anger, greed, envy, pride. In fact, war is a tremendous example of where a lot of these sins combine. And I wanted to point that out, in that if we go back and look at tribal warfare and try to make some connection with modern warfare, which is difficult to do, but in tribal warfare, there's almost a constant kind of warfare going on in many cases between groups. And it's a sort of ecologically based, in terms of trying to provide. Now, the anthropologist Marvin Harris has come up with a pretty good theory of this tribal warfare, which also explains male superiority and female inferiority in society. And his question is, why is it that the hand that rocks the cradle allows women who control the socialization of males, allow males to become superior to them? And his answer has to do with tribal warfare. What he points out is that what happens in primitive tribes is that powerful males take more than one wife. And this has to do with building up wealth and position and power. It has to do with these other sins, greed, pride, and so on. And it leaves younger males without wives. And so they go marauding. They go out to other tribes and steal women from other tribes. And this is constantly going on. When it went on in the Plains American Indian tribes as a continual process. So because in these conditions and the kinds of weapons that are used, males have a natural superiority because of upper arm strength and so on. Women, what you find is, and anthropologists have documented this in a number of different places, is that the birth rate for males and females in these tribes is pretty much what it is in any society. But by the time of puberty, there's a lot more males than there are females. So what happened to the females in the meantime? Well, they were left out with exposure and died. They were not fed. They slowly just waste away as children, as babies. They're less valued. The reason they're less valued is because the women want to give their attention to the males and raising them to be strong warriors to protect them. But of course, what this means is that now there's less females to go around, which causes the men to go out and maraud in the other tribes, which creates more female infanticide. And so you have this cycle that continues and over time. And then we bring up that to modern times, and we see we don't have such a need for that in modern societies, it doesn't seem any longer. We have different kinds of weapons. And so we don't see that type of selective killing of children the way that we have in the past. But I wanted to point that also, because tomorrow I want to show a movie about rape, and about how these different social meanings and sins and evils come together in this one particular kind of crime. But it becomes combined. There's a tendency to think of rape in terms of lust, but rape has many other meanings too, and in relationship to these other sins. Anger, as a way of venting anger, as a way of achieving wealth. Envy, as a way of taking out feelings of envy, and so on. Anger. Why is anger a sin? Unleashed, it has severe consequences sometimes. How does society channel anger? Can you think of any examples?
Competition.
Unfortunately, sometimes, Monday Night Football, you mentioned that.
Well, hard stuff.
Right. Or football, maybe some sports. Anger, though, is something that isn't true joy. Anger is something that's not necessarily supposed to come into sport. Right?
No, but aggression is important.
Well, when does anger... examine yourself. When do you get angry?
When I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, I think it's when it might be when somebody's afraid, but also when one feels that one has not been treated fairly. Rights have been violated. Or when one is punished for something one doesn't believe one deserves. Those kinds of things. That's when anger really comes out. And you see the evil potential for this in terms of killing, and it's also its use in war to excite people, to try to get them to feel anger toward the enemy. I was talking to someone about this the other night, that how surprised Americans are when they visit the Soviet Union and find that the Soviets don't hate them, but in fact are very friendly. And but when we think about it in our country, we think about Russians and we have a tendency to be to have some antipathy toward them, that they're our enemy, you know, that we have righteous anger toward them. It doesn't seem to go both ways, however. Some of the most tragic examples of this have to do with juvenile delinquency, and especially by kids who have been abused by their parents and have developed an intense sense of anger, a hatred that is in their deep down inside of them, that they live with in their lives. Think about this, when a child tries to be gracious and friendly and giving to an adult and receives rejection in return, what that does to a person if it happens over and over and over again. Can it ever be rectified? Can it ever be changed? It's very difficult. It's a real task. In my work, I've talked to a lot of kids who are delinquents and crooks who are former delinquents. And the thing that always comes up is the foster home experience. That they lost their family, and it wasn't their fault, but they were punished for it. In other words, kids are cut loose on the street by their parents because of family disorder. And then they're punished for that. They're punished by the criminal justice system, the juvenile justice system, by foster home experiences. And they didn't deserve it. And that comes out in very socially destructive ways later on. Greed, that's probably the best example in our society of channeling something in supposedly socially useful directions. Greed is the all-American sin. Greed is the one that our economy is based upon. The Henry Ford, other great wealthy people, wrote philosophies justifying greed, and how unlimited greed betters society. There's probably something to that. You know, it's the idea that if this is what we want, if we want this economic self-development, then maybe we need to give almost free rein to greed, to that sin of greed. That's a way of taking care of it. Greed may or may not be a problem in our society because of the way we handle it. See, with sin, there's only a couple things you can do. You can withstand it or you can give in to it. It's taken care of either way. It doesn't become a problem then. Yes?
I just wanted to mention that in some of the famous passages that we like to bring up in Corinthians about homosexuality, greed is mentioned right along with homosexuality as a grievous sin to stay away from. But the conversations that arouse passion are on homosexuality, and yet greed, probably if we use 40% of the world's resources, probably more children are dying today because of that sin. But a lot of churches have cornerstones, a lot of them. Maybe of the robber barons, you know, especially in the East. It's an interesting thing that greed does not arouse the passion in us, and yet it's mentioned right along all the time in homosexuality. Right in the same sentence.
Yeah.
What does it arouse the passion?
The reason it doesn't is because it's what we've given into it.
What?
It's not a problem for us. We've given into it.
Would we have progress if we didn't have greed?
No. It's made a great country.
Yeah.
Anybody want to talk to that?
The problem is that Scripture has something to say.
You know, if
saying, "Well, God, we made a great country for this sin."
Yeah, we have a great success story in this country by not giving in to greed. Of course, the Soviet Union. What? By giving in to greed. Of course, the Soviet Union and pretty soon the People's Republic of China are even going to have greater success stories by controlling greed. But see, envy and greed are in relationship to one another. It's almost like you have one, you give into one, and then you got a problem with the other, or vice versa. Envy, if you try to control greed too much, maybe envy becomes too big of a problem. And likewise, if you try to control envy, then one of the things we do is if we give unlimited rein to greed, then envy is supposed to not have a place in our society. There's no reason you should be envious. You can get whatever you want. See, that's the philosophy behind it.
Is it a sin to want to improve yourself, your faith in the law?
No, but it depends on the purpose for that, of that reason. See, greed is almost like a game, or has been in our society. Why do people want all this wealth? It's a strange story. You know, you get these stories like Andrew Carnegie, who amassed all this wealth and then gave it all away and went off and lived in Scotland. You think about the game of Monopoly, which is also an all-American game based on greed. What happens if somebody wins? The game's over. We have to start over again. And that's what's happened and happening in our society, see, is the concentration of wealth at the top. And occasionally you got to quit the game and start over again and divvy it up, or else the game won't go on.
I think it's interesting, too, that we associate that with improving ourselves. I mean, there's 100,000 different ways you can improve ourselves, but in America, it's he who dies with the most toys wins. Psychology. Right. That we say we're improving ourselves. That may not be improving yourself, you know. There are a lot of people in the community I live, which is one of the wealthiest in the country, that are on cocaine and drugs, and they have more money than the other one.
It's true. Improving means
so
sort of...
You have to find definitions for improving yourself.
Right. And they're cultural based, you know, in a sense. What's wrong with giving everything away to the poor?
Right. So maybe
is that improving yourself? It certainly is in one sense.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it has to do with how one uses their wealth, I think, too, or how one uses their power. Freud, of course, in psychoanalysis, makes this opposing distinction between greed and love. That greed is a substitute for love, and that one takes the place of the other, and has a whole psychoanalysis associated with that. I think Christmas is probably the best manifestation of that relationship you could find. Originally, Christmas is supposed to be a celebration of love coming into the world and showing us how to grow and become like God. Whereas now the meaning of Christmas is, if it's not a good season, the whole economy will fail. You know, it's buying, 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 and we have to help out the economy that way. As I said, envy has a connection to greed, especially in a consumerist society like ours. Economists pinpoint about 1950, 51, 52, when our society switched over from being a producing society to a consuming society. All other societies, except those highly advanced economies, have a problem of production. They don't produce enough. About 1951, 52, we all of a sudden started, about 50% of our production was surplus. And so our problem now is consumption. We don't consume enough. And so the advertising industry has really come on, you know, since that time, has been the major growth industry in our society as a way of helping along our consumerism. And the trick in advertising is to tie buying particular items to metaphors that we consider are envious or covetous of. Maybe you're acquainted with Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, you know, those kinds of things. You can use those, like needs like belonging, physical needs, self actualization needs, all of those things, love, whatever, that are human needs, and find that that's how things are sold to us. You know, you buy this thing and you will get this particular need fulfilled. Of course, that's a shallow way of looking at things, also a lie. So what happens is you buy those things and you don't feel fulfilled, and so you got to buy the next thing. I just thought, I do this with one of my classes, ask them to take an ad and analyze it in this regard. I just picked up some cigarette ones, you know, and you can look at what are they selling. That's a female cigarette. It's like, you know, if you want to be the new woman, you know, the cosmopolitan person, or whatever, you know, that's... Here's another one of a different, little different type. Oops. See this one. This is also a female cigarette. But the single most successful advertising metaphor in American history has been this one. It's been around the longest time. Now, this is even, I think, even more to the point. What is it selling? What are they selling? That appeals to Americans so much.
Individualism, rugged.
Rugged individualism. And notice the opposite of civilization. They're selling...
Identity.
Yeah, the idea of going out in nature, it's just you against nature, no women. That's true. And it's a thread... Women, see, represent civilization, family. And what Marlborough is appealing to is the absence of all of these things that tie a person down. It's a thread that runs through American literature, too. You find very few heroines, if any, in American literature. And the great American books are these, like Moby Dick and... Mark Twain's books, Huckleberry Finn, and so on, are going out, leaving society, and finding oneself, you know, the quest. Even goes through Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye. Gluttony is the last one, and gluttony is translated, I think, these days in terms of addictions. It's interesting, in social history, I think, you know, like the difference between Northern Europeans and Southern Europeans in terms of table manners. You know, Northern Europeans, you're supposed to sit at the table and eat like you hate food. You're not supposed to be seen eating. You know, you keep your hands off the table, you're down there, and you take a little bit, and you eat a little bit at a time, and all this thing to look like you really don't want to eat. And you compare that or contrast it to Southern Europeans, you know, huge platters of food, 12 courses. You can really see the difference between giving in to the sin, you know, and trying to withstand it. But, you know, probably the worst thing, in gluttons, you know, why don't we like gluttons? Where I hate gluttons is like when you're preparing a meal and they come out in the kitchen and start picking at it before you've served it. I hate that. Also, you know, they have trouble when, you know, sitting in chairs, when you sit next to somebody who's really large. Portliness, of course, used to call it portliness. You know, used to be kind of a sign of social success and good humor, and those kinds of things. But I think what it has more meaning for today is in terms of addictions of one sort or another in our society, and especially chemical substances of one sort or another. And you look at this as a major problem in modern societies, and again you can see who bears the brunt of this problem. Who do we persecute and scapegoat for this problem? In New York, giving the death penalty to heroin pushers. Great men, and I don't know about women, but it's documented, great men have made their careers and been dope addicts, heroin addicts the whole time. Heroin is much less of a problem physiologically and in terms of inhibiting one's work or life routine than something like alcohol. In other words, the reason we persecute heroin addicts is not because of the pharmacology that's involved and its influence on the body. The reason we do it is because we're scapegoating them for these ritually accepted drugs that we have, like especially alcohol. And some people might want to say coffee, too, if they're anti-coffee addicts. But, you know, it does so much danger to our society. But we don't hold the alcohol companies responsible for this at all. You know, probably because they make such good commercials, beer commercials, anyway. But, you know, it would be, if I had my druthers, I would make them spend a dollar. If for every dollar profit they made, I would have them spend a dollar in terms of anti-alcohol propaganda or programs of one sort or another. Because I don't think they have a right to make all that profit and cause all that social damage and make the rest of us pay for it. But that's the current state of affairs. Well, we're coming right up against 5 o'clock. I wanted to summarize by making a couple points. Each of these sins represents some source of social disunity. And the idea is, how can we channel, in society the problem is, how do we channel these things in so that maybe they will benefit society, or at least they won't cause so many problems. Some people have said, like in terms of drama and literature is a way of doing this, that really good drama, theater, movies, and so on, you can actually feel through the sins yourself without actually committing them. In other words, you can go through a morality play, as they used to be called, and see what happens and have the motivation, the feeling, see it happen, and then come out at the end. The theater of Artaud's theater, it's a theory of theater. This is a particular theory of theater in modern times. Something that's a possibility. I wanted to particularly come down on war, because I think war is the primary example that activates almost all of these sins and channels them in extremely destructive directions and prevents social growth or individual growth. The results of war tend to always be to make certain classes inferior, women inferior, these types of things, and certain people to be used for other ends and objectifying others for our purposes. And then the last thing I wanted to say has to do with temptation, sacrifice, and spiritual growth. And this sort of gets back to the theology of it again. That withstanding temptation is one way that we grow and feel better about ourselves. There's a new concept I just came across a couple weeks ago called the New Puritans. And it's, you know, this new phenomenon in our society of real concentration on diet and exercise. These people trying to, you know, withstand all these temptations that especially have to do with food. And, you know, going back to the old Puritan ideals. When we give in to our temptations, we may take care of them. In other words, they're not problems for us anymore. But I don't think we grow, especially spiritually, when we do that. I think we sort of fall back. It's laziness. We go back to the way that that is the easiest path. And, of course, there's in Romans somewhere there, there's that statement by Paul about suffering and growth and hope. One way of dealing with these problems in modern times to relieve ourselves of responsibility is to put ourselves in the care of somebody else to take care of the problem for us. Since overeating happens to be an obsession with our modern society, you see a lot of examples of this, of people who get their intestines cut. What do they call that operation? I can't remember. What? Yeah, intestinal bypass surgery, or stapling the stomach, taking pills, and these kinds of things. Putting oneself, putting one's own spiritual life in the care of somebody else, or in the responsibility of somebody else, is just another sidetrack of not handling the difficulties. But I don't want to, condemn these things so much. That it may be something that is a sign to others, or maybe to the person who's undergoing it themselves, that they need to change direction in their lives. Well, anybody have anything they would like to say, just quickly, or maybe not so quickly?
Could I would like to contribute something.
Sure.
In defense of women, in the past, there's never been any great chefs that were women.
Yes, there have.
The life is a game of percentages. The big percentages have been men, but now women are coming to the forefront. They're taking over. They're the ones that there are more home economists that are women, and more of them dietitians are women than there ever was men. I've never heard of men. And they've made a tremendous progress along the field. And I think the same thing you would be on the line of artists. Most of the art in the past has been the great artists have all been men.
That's true.
But now I think they're coming to the forefront, and they will be, unfortunately for the men, will be the rulers. I feel this, that you see more honest politicians are women than are the biggest crooks have been men.
Well, wait till women get the power. You'll see a lot of crooked women.
Place of forgiveness in this.
What?
Oh, the place of forgiveness, and you're talking about sin evil.
Yeah. Forgiveness is an act by whom? By the society or by individuals?
You mean to the people that are offending?
Is that the kind of forgiveness that you're talking about?
Well, if you're dealing with sin or with it, both from God's perspective as far as Him's forgiving sin and thus potentially freeing the person for a change in society.
Okay.
But also then the relationship of us to each other within society. That though we can expect it of each other, we don't necessarily exclude each other for it, but the forgiveness for that, because they're not stupid.
Why do you think, what was the purpose of Pope, what's his name, John Paul?
Yeah.
Visiting his attempted assassin in his cell and forgiving him. It was obviously to make that person grow spiritually, right?